This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. Feeling thirsty? You might already be dehydrated. Enter Liquid IV. Behind every great-tasting sip is a science-backed formula of electrolytes and nutrients made to quickly replenish fluids lost from sweat. Every stick is powered by 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink. Redefine the refresh with Liquid IV, also available in sugar-free. Tear, pour, live more. Visit us at liquidiv.com.
Hi, and welcome to Is It My ADHD? The podcast about what it really feels like to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I'm Grace Timothy, and I'm a writer, and I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD until I was 37. I'd struggled with traits I now know to be ADHD all my life, but it wasn't until a routine hearing appointment with a doctor who happened to have ADHD himself that these traits were pieced together, and it was suggested that I get referred for an assessment. Had it not been for that random moment with an audiologist, I'd still be undiagnosed now and still struggling, just like the 2 million women thought to have undiagnosed ADHD in the UK today. I want to better understand what ADHD feels like for women and non-binary people, in whom ADHD is so often missed, thanks to the fact that the diagnostic criteria and research is all heavily skewed to the white male case study. I've therefore spoken to some incredible women about how ADHD affects their lives, exploring everything from friendship and work to dating and self-esteem. I've also pulled in some experts along the way to help us tackle the big questions from you and from my guests. Is it my ADHD when I ghost old friends, for example? Is it my ADHD when I break the photocopier at work? And is it my ADHD when I share nudes on Instagram? My hope is that we can spread awareness of ADHD in women and non-binary people, and that you'll find some comfort in knowing you're far from being alone. Because with the right support, we can be truly amazing. Today we're looking at boom and bust, the cycle of hyperfocus followed by a physical or emotional crash. And we'll be talking to author and campaigner Rebecca Schiller about how that's played out in her life. It's not yet part of the official criteria for diagnosing ADHD, and yet it's come up time and time again when I speak to both experts and folks with ADHD. Boom and bust, the idea that you go all out and then collapse in a heap. For me, it's always been something I've confused with being physically ill, being lazy, having anxiety, or having depression. I'll absolutely go to town at work when that hyperfocus kicks in, without taking breaks or even really eating, and then crash, I'm done in. Or I'll go out night after night and then suddenly I'm in bed for an entire weekend. It can be smaller things. A big chat at the school gate with someone who's new to me can result in an evening of being monosyllabic and floppy. It's exhausting masking and just navigating the neurotypical and, by the way, capitalist society with all its gender norms and expectations around hard work and conformity. Rebecca Schiller is an author, journalist and women's rights campaigner and unbelievably manages to do so much more on the side. A tireless advocate for the childbirth charity Birthrights, as well as issues of inclusivity, and the founder of the Mothers Who Write Network and Writers Retreats, all the while running a small holding in Kent with her husband and 2 children. Rebecca is busy. I got to know her really well on one of her writers retreats as she finished her memoir Earthed, which came out this year. What I didn't know at the time was that she was midway through the ADHD diagnostic process, and Earthed was the book that opened my eyes to what ADHD really looked like for a woman of today. In this book, I recognised the same boom and bust cycle I had endured for the best part of 30 years. Rebecca, I'm so happy to have you here today.
This is really exciting.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's so nice to see you. Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you. I think one of the biggest things that stood out to me in the book and just talking to you afterwards was this idea that you were trying to hide like your 8 slimy octopus legs that no one else was aware of, no one else could see, but inside you, you were trying to suppress something. Is that something that now you've had that light bulb moment, does it feel the same, or has that sort of evolved at all with the knowledge? Is that octopus still kind of flailing around?
Yeah, I think the octopus is. I think the strange thing about being suddenly aware, A, that you're masking and that that's hard, and that you're hiding something, and the thing you're hiding is something that you've learned to really hate. On my side, I've learned that this is bad, and therefore I should hide it, and I'm very ashamed of it. And I think I'd like to get to a place where I don't hate the bad stuff, and the octopus and I are one, make friends with my octopus. But I think for me, it's been quite traumatic to be so aware of it's often excruciating masking, and to be able to be aware of it and then feel it. And then also have to be confronted with my inner slimy octopus messiness and know that I should love it, but have spent, 39 years hiding it and hating it. It's actually been really, really difficult. But I think that process, I hope, will be one that allows me to be much more sort of integrated, instead of being both a mask and a hidden octopus, and then, working very hard to bridge that gap.
You say in Earthed, the pressure and struggle to keep up the facade under society's intense and unequal scrutiny, gender roles and expectations that are already unfair, unachievable, are made all the harder to meet. You also say, I cover it up, referring to ADHD-led behaviours. What's the cost of this process to you physically?
I think it comes at an extraordinary physical cost. I mean, I have got to a point, over the past couple of years, where I've realised that I'm actually sort of physically clenching every single muscle. There was none left. and that was actually sort of, it's been quite difficult and physically painful to work out that I've sort of various hypertonic muscles that are just holding on, clinging on, and exhaustion, reaching a point where I can ignore. And I feel like this is common to lots of neurodivergent people I've spoken to, that have got quite a high tolerance for different kinds of pain and distress and don't notice them for a very, 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 very long time, and can pop up the next morning like a little jack in the box, pop up in the morning, I'm ready to go again, having the night before sometimes thought, I don't know how I'm going to face this day. And that can be really useful, but I think it eventually for me gets to a point where I'm completely physically, emotionally exhausted. So yes, I think sensory triggers get much worse, my sort of attention span, my decision making abilities, and I've experienced, particularly over the last 5 years, a sort of increasing cycle of being really sort of falling out of the world, being very unable to do even the basic things that I would normally do, and shrinking my life down, even though I'm very busy and I've got lots of things on, actually shrinking everything else around it, not driving as much, not going to the supermarket, taking everything else possibly off my agenda without realizing it. And I think that's an experience that lots of neurodivergent people, I think, have, and not realizing it until perhaps it's a little bit too late.
Well, I think, it all resonates, but I think there's two boom and bust cycles, it seems. There's the micro, which is the everyday of I had to be switched on all day today, and now I'm absolutely beside myself and anxious and depressed and tired, all those things. But then there's the macro, isn't there, where it's a year. And at the end of that year, you go, holy shit, how am I still alive? And how am I going to do that again? And it kind of creeps up on you, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think for me, and I'm using the inverted commas sign at this moment, resilience around the micro boom and bust contributes to how the macro, how serious the kind of macro boom and bust is. And I think I've also realised that I really sort of have beaten myself up about not being able to change that, thinking it's very, very bad. Why am I doing so many things? I'm overcommitting, I'm not prioritizing, and I'm overworking, I'm burning myself out. And then on the bus side, then I, you know, I'm completely unable to do things, and seeing that as a very, very negative cycle. And of course, for me, it has been, but also trying to engage with what parts of that cycle are kind of positive and normal for me, and what aspects of the negative boom and bust might not necessarily be the way I do things being wrong, but the way I do things being misunderstood, or in combination with how you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do, what a normal work life is supposed to look like, what success looks like, and thinking about whether there's ways to make my natural inclinations work for me, rather than be compelled to do all of these things, but somehow try and stuff them into a very neurotypical box. And I think for me, a lot of the tension, a lot of the distress is around needing to be a certain way because of my neurodivergent brain, but then trying to put that in a nice little neurotypical package and present it to the world as, oh no, I'm just doing the normal success. Don't worry. Yeah. This is what it looks like. And so I think there is a sort of, for me, a tension there between not trying to learn to be normal, but trying to learn to be me. And I'm looking forward to knowing how to do that.
Well, and I don't know how do you deal with the bust? Because I feel like a big part of both of us being diagnosed was that we understood what happened in the past, right? And we could understand how we were feeling in that moment as well. But when you look to the future, if that boom and bust, if that kind of cycle of like, I'm in it, I'm still going, oh, and my, you know, I seem to be more resilient this time, I'll keep going until that runs out. I think the thing that worries me about the future a little bit is like, I don't see how that's going to change. But also I need to learn how to deal with the bust if it's not going to change, because otherwise it impacts on other people, doesn't it? We both know, as, you know, the matriarchs.
Yes. Yes. And I think there's a few things for me that I've been trying to think about and work on. One of those is just permission to let myself, I've been trying to think of it as flowing, a kind of flowing much more through what I want to do, rather than setting myself a lot of kind of arbitrary targets. And sometimes that looks like, I know I have to do my tax return. I know I have to do my tax return. And normally I would have that on a lot of lists, and I still wouldn't do it until the last minute, but I would have it on a lot of lists. And so I just haven't made a list. And I do still know I have to do my tax return. And I've never not done my tax return on time, ever. But looking at how much of the emotional effort of boom is holding on to things like, I must do my tax return, I mustn't forget, because it would be so terrible if I forgot to do my tax return, putting that on 15 different lists. And yet, having been someone who has never, ever missed a tax return deadline, I'm having an attempt to kind of see what happens if I just sort of let myself flow a little bit, and see what happens if I make some mistakes and forget things. And I think for me, I wonder whether the bust will be lessened because what I'm doing is taking a bit of pressure off myself emotionally, realizing that the consequences of some of the things that are very intense for me in a boom cycle are about the covering up, the doing things right. And if I perhaps find ways to take those out, I'm taking the pressure off myself a bit. And I think it's also, I was thinking about it with with oversharing. I was like, oh, I wonder what Grace and I will talk about. Maybe I might overshare. And I thought that's a funny thing to talk to Grace about, thinking about what you've written about and what I've written about. And people have said to me, you know, you're so honest, you said so much. And I sometimes feel bad about that. And I think about it in social settings. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. That was definitely TMI. And why do I do that? And so realizing that that's just how I am. There's no point for me in having those conversations that are very surface level. I can't do that. It's not, I see what the real conversation is and that's what I want to have. But realizing that that has a cost. So instead of spending the emotional energy on thinking, I should learn to set better boundaries, I shouldn't talk about this stuff, and then being upset with myself for putting myself in that position, perhaps thinking about the frequency in which I put myself in that position, or what it is I might need to do in the 2 weeks after, say, I run a writing retreat, which is full of super intense conversations and sharing, that maybe I need not to see many people for the next couple of weeks. And trying to put that to myself more as, this is who you are, this is how you do things, and that's fine. You want to overshare? That's the only way you can share. Maybe it's not oversharing for you. Maybe it's just how you are. But what do you need to be able to be like that? And finding where all of that difficulty and energy is in the boom cycle, it isn't in having loads of ideas. That doesn't cost me stuff. And actually deciding to paint my whole house or dig up the vegetable patch or do an advent calendar, that takes some energy, but it's nice energy. I like doing that stuff. The place where it gets really grimy and grotty is where I'm trying to make that normal, make that what everybody else does, hide things. And so I feel like for me, the more I can strip that out and work on my own terms, I'm hoping that the bust bit, where I might just need to stand around and look at the sky for 3 weeks, seeing that not as, oh, I've had a breakdown, I can't do anything, I'm rubbish, but like, oh, this is my bit where I just need to like gather again. I need to go out and like recharge myself. I've been expending and now I get to plug myself in. And maybe that is exactly the same as a really negative boom and bust, but inside, when I say that, it feels much better.
Well, we need to rename it, possibly. Boom and bust is a little bit, that's a little bit harsh. But also, I mean, I think talking of oversharing, and that's another standard that's been set outside of us. Mm-hmm. So I would never have a conversation with you and think, holy, like, that's a lot of information, Rebecca. I did not need to know. Like, that would just, it wouldn't cross my mind to think like that. And so that kind of thing where people say that the things that we've written are brave or raw or any of those things, it's like, it's just what comes out. So it's your standard that's maybe slightly different. And it doesn't mean that your standard is the right standard, you know?
No. I think that's, and it's interesting that people's reactions to the, particularly the very difficult mental health stuff that I've written, and I'm sure you've had similar responses. Some people are so lit up by it, even though it's difficult stuff. Like, oh, I'm so grateful to read this. It's made me, and I've spoken to some people who you can tell are really upset and discomforted and can't quite understand. And you can hear from the tone of their voice that their question is a little bit, are you aware that you wrote this and you sent it out and the other people that I've read it, that I know this stuff about you? And that's when I find it hard. And it's because that sets off my internal, oh, I did the wrong thing. There was a rule. I broke
your
it.
Your octopus is like out.
Yeah.
There.
It's like that. I've left slime on your on your
you
sofa.
You slapped her around the face with a tentacle. That's the problem.
Yeah. And the level of awfulness I feel about that, about the rule breaking, I think is something that takes a huge amount of my energy.
Yeah.
If I wasn't expending quite so much energy on feeling bad about that, I might have a bit more left in when my sort of super active phase comes to an end.
It's really interesting when you were saying about your boom phase and the things that you find energy for and how you've sort of ended up at times shrinking your existence down. But with lockdown, I didn't go through any boom and bust whatsoever. I did lots. I achieved lots. I achieved small things, like I washed the car seat covers. I've never done that in my life. I should have done it years ago. It was disgusting. But I've never done it because I cannot add that to my list. My mental list is too long. And I found such utter peace in lockdown, because the decisions were, what do I wear today? You know, what shall I do? I had lots of creative ideas, because although I couldn't, you know, take any to fruition because I was looking after my daughter and homeschooling and all that stuff, it was a much more fertile ground for just being myself, like you say, finding inspiration and getting things done that, as I say, I've never been able to do before. What was your experience of the world sort of shutting you out a little bit at that time, and how that affected the process?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to suddenly be forced into a situation I'd already been creating for myself. You know, moving to a small holding, the first thing I did is, there were no gates and we needed them. We had small children at the time. It was a busy road, but I had the gates installed when we moved in very quickly. I wanted gates. I wanted to be able to stop people coming in. Not because I never want to see anybody, but the thought of somebody's surprise popping in, it's like the worst thing ever. Please never do that to me. You are never welcome to pop into my house. I will lie if you do it, but I will hate it a lot. But it was some aspects of it were so freeing. The kind of micro decisions that lots of other people don't worry about that I worry about were removed. And I realised I've been doing a strange project of rewriting the book Earth that I wrote for the UK for an American publisher. It's almost a completely different book, though about the same time period. Because turns out, if you want someone with ADHD to be interested in doing it again, they have to make it new.
Was a lot of the newness kind of self-directed then?
There were some requests to, because when I started writing Earthed, I had no idea that ADHD would be part of it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I love about the book is that it's a real evolution across quite a short space of time, a book that set out to be about a small holding and ended up being about being neurodivergent. But because I did know by the time it was going to America, they really wanted to focus on that aspect of it. And also it had been a year, and quite an intense year, and I was able to come back to the aspect of sort of neurodivergence and think about it again. But of course, I couldn't just leave it at that. And I am someone that likes to spot patterns and links and for everything to fit together. Once you start tinkering with one bit, when you clean your kitchen and you clean one bit and then everything else looks not quite right and you have to do the next bit.
Yeah.
It was a bit like that. I realised that the things I had been shutting out of my life before lockdown, cutting down on, were things that involved engaging with other people in an unsafe way for me, which in fact is almost every way. So it was particularly things where I would find the environment stressful, like the supermarket, and commuting, meetings with people that I didn't know, socialising in situ. It was all about presenting myself to the world. The things where I do loads of stuff at home, with people that I really know and really trust, were fine. And so lockdown, in lots of ways was a relief, because that stuff was taken away. I think for me it was a little bit different because I was doing some quite intense work projects. And coming out of that, this spring I was doing a lot of publicity. So even though it was from here, it did involve a lot of engaging with the outside world again. But part of that process and part of writing the American edition, which is called A Thousand Ways to Pay Attention, was realizing that some of the negative things that I experience in Boom are about trauma, and that I had developed a trauma response to engaging with the world. And that was just getting more and more and more and more severe the more I did that, and that in some ways lockdown was really helpful with that, but actually, I think you put a lot of additional stresses in, and the more you don't do something, the more difficult it gets as well. So that's been a big revelation and a big part of my own sort of development and trying to sort of get better and get healthier, is actually looking at what aspects of my way of doing things are driven by trauma, and where does that trauma live and how can I deal with it? And so the way I've been talking about Boom and Bust with you now is really informed by having been having trauma therapy for essentially my lovely GP, who you will have read about in Earthed, who is a total hero, said to me, I think maybe you need some trauma therapy. And I was like, I haven't had a traumatic event, it's fine. He was like, no, but what about your entire life?
That, oh God, that, what about that, your
that,
life?
Yeah, hasn't your life, you know, hasn't that been quite, you know, a series of micro and then less micro? I was like, oh, yes, hang on, that sounds about right. And I think that's something, again, when I talk to other neurodivergent people and read what they've written, and that even if we're not talking about it as trauma, the way that it manifests, and the when you get to that point, the bust point, for me, that bust is an inability to hide and manage my response to trauma. A lot of it is that there's an exhaustion, there's a, you know, I'm physically and emotionally tired from doing all of these things, but I actually need to be really busy. I need to move my body. I need to have lots of ideas. I don't need to be having that sort of deeply held negative response to myself, sort of brought on by the outside world all the time. And I think for me, that's when it all, there'll be one thing too many in there. Oh, this makes me hate myself a lot. And that's the thing that tends to bring on the, and now I can't anymore. Now I need to, you know, I need to retreat completely.
I think it's important to differentiate as well. Boom and bust isn't like being on a treadmill at 100 miles an hour for an hour and then having to sleep. As you say, it's the burden of masking and of fitting in. So actually, presumably, I mean, like, for example, we could spend maybe a weekend together and not experience the bust, because there is no pretense, there's no falseness there. It is just, you can be who you want to be. And it's the same, presumably, you know, with your partner and often with your kids and things. But it's about society making that not okay and you having to deal with that, the fallout of whatever that is.
Yeah, I think there's definitely the kind of broader ableist society, the way that we're supposed to work. Yeah. Have a goal, but make sure it's just one goal. Don't be scattered or distracted or have too many. Don't pick things up and put them down. That's bad. What would be the benefit of that? You need one, and you need to march steadily towards it with equally sized steps. Just take one every day. Don't run for a bit. Don't stop and pause. Definitely don't have an idea and put lots into it and then drop it. You can turn those into diagnostic criteria and pathologize them. And they can absolutely be really destructive and difficult. But I've been reading some of the stuff that a really brilliant designer and kind of advocate called Marta Rhodes has written. And she talks about time and the idea that if you wildly expand your time period in which you consider success as someone who's neurodivergent, you might find that, yeah, you had an idea and you put it down 5 years ago, but that's the thing that's sparking your idea today. And that why is it, if you're someone that generates a lot of ideas, it's okay to have 15 and try 15 of them out and maybe only one of them sticks. And that it might be okay to have periods, so the idea of an ellipsis, periods where you're really, really fast and everything's coming together, and then you need a bit where you stand and stare out of the window. That's not okay if you're trying to run a factory. You need everybody to show up at the same time every day and work in a methodical way. But actually, that way of working is not okay for lots of people, lots of more neurotypical people. But it is often definitely not okay for people with ADHD, autistic people and other neurodivergent people. So yeah, it's that sort of trying to understand which bits of that cycle are helpful and which are society treading on your toes, and also the internalized stuff. Actually, sometimes society would be fine with me doing this shit. They don't care, they don't even notice. It's just that I'm so like, please don't notice anything, that for me the consequences, I remember somebody who'd read saying, yeah, but people always, like, you made this big deal about forgetting two meetings in a row, and people do that, people forget stuff. It doesn't mean they've got ADHD just because they forget things. And I really thought about that. I was like, maybe that's right. It's like, why is it so abnormal? It's like how awful it was for me to have forgotten anything.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to forget anything, because then people will see, you know, the octopus.
Yeah. It's a lot of people will say, but I experienced this, but I experienced that. What's ADHD and what's just, you know, 21st century womanhood, 21st century humanity? Like, it's just the intensity and the frequency, isn't it, that just differentiates. I'm so excited to announce that this podcast is sponsored by the first makeup brand I ever bought as a teenager, Benefit Cosmetics. I saved up for Benetton for weeks, and that love remained strong when I became a beauty editor years later. Roller Lash is my absolute favourite mascara of all time. Gimme Brow Plus and Precisely My Brow are my go-to brow products, and I still use Benetton on the daily. Makeup is something I reach for to give myself a moment to ground, to breathe, and be in my own thoughts for a minute. Just like my own personal form of meditation that happens to help make me feel fierce. Benefit has remained a mainstay in my own routine for more reasons than one. I love the way Benefit connects customers with amazing causes, and today is amplifying various voices around neurodivergence. I'll be working with Benefit not just on the podcast, but they've also asked me to explore how the Benefit counter experience can be more accessible to those with brains a bit like mine. I'll be sharing the ways we're working together and would love to hear your thoughts on this too. I still can't believe I'm launching Is It My ADHD with my OG beauty obsession at the heart. What I thought was interesting about, you know, when you're talking about the way that we have to engage with people and how that often is a huge part of the bust, mm-hmm. is that so many of the things might look like anxiety. So when I would say to Rich, I cannot face going into London tomorrow. I cannot face that. It would look to him like, right, we need to help Grace with her anxiety because she's frightened. And I would think, but I'm not, and I can't. And that's actually even harder for me to access the help because, you know, I tried CBT and I did all the reading you could do. And, you know, I've worked on anxiety in quote marks for, well, since I was about 8. And actually, there's a freeness to realizing it's not something that you can necessarily work on and fix like that. It's about maybe changing the approach to the whole situation. And I think with that, there's an acceptability, isn't there? And also there's a sort of forgiveness of self. Did you feel any kind of freeness or freedom off the back of your diagnosis that that's what it was?
Yes, definitely. At the time when I sort of stumbled across this article and realised ADHD might be a thing for me, I was having NHS CBT and they'd been through several models under which they were trying to treat me, and they'd ended up with clinical perfectionism. It started with generalised anxiety disorder and then moved to clinical perfectionism. And I was trying really hard to accept that I was both of those people and to learn essentially that my problem was I wanted everything to be absolutely perfect. It was completely unacceptable for me if things weren't extraordinarily perfect. And then this was tying myself up in all of these anxious knots. So I cared about things that did not matter, that weren't important. I worried about things that I didn't need to worry about, that weren't worrying. And I needed to learn how to not care about things an abnormal amount and worry about things that weren't important and upsetting. So, you know what, it's been really validating to realise that actually I worry about those things because for me, they are genuinely worrying. They are difficult. They have proven time and time again in my life to be painful, that I might have a really horrible experience that will have a long-term consequence, that perhaps those things actually require a real effort, a planning process for me, because they are things that I find particularly tricky to remember or engage with. It's not just that I'm worrying, you know, you're talking about going on the train. If you see that as just anxiety, then it's not necessarily a worrying thing, not just anxiety, because anxiety is and I have definitely experienced anxiety and it is an awful, awful thing. But it is freeing to realise that I'm anxious about something because it has a basis in it being a difficult or painful thing or something that has had negative consequences. And looking at it through that framework makes me realise why being treated under the other frameworks was not helpful. Yeah. And trying, you know, that was a really difficult thing for me. Why am I not doing better? Like, why can't I just accept that I'm a perfectionist and none of this matters? When I see that as, I see the world differently to some other people, and that this thing that somebody else can't see for me is a giant beacon flashing that I absolutely cannot ignore. And that's what makes me good at some of the stuff I'm good at. So I can't just continue to be good at all the stuff I'm good at but just dial it down when it's inconvenient for everybody else, which mm-hmm. I think is a lot of what neurodivergent people experience. Oh, continue to have great ideas, continue to be really fast paced and connect the dots, continue to see lateral thinking and see things that other people don't see, but don't manifest that in a negative way. Don't you dare see something and worry about it, you know, if you worry about it, that's going to cause me some inconvenience, and I'd rather you didn't do that, because that's abnormal, that's you just being an anxious perfectionist. And I think perhaps I'm at the angry stage of the process of coming to terms with it, because now that just makes me want to throw things.
I love that for you. You go throw.
Yeah, I don't know who I would throw it at though, kind of amorphous. But yeah, it is freeing, I think, to realise it was hard. It felt hard because it is hard. Mm. And that for me, some of the things that are, I've got a friend who was talking about how I do things the hard way a lot of the time. And I think about that really often. And I had a revelation this year that for me, the hard way is often the easy way, and the easy way is the hard way.
Well, and also, do you find now a voice to say to people, not necessarily in your direct family who understand now what's going on, but maybe sometimes with work or the HMRC, that, you know, okay, stop for a minute because I need help, or this is what I'm going through, like, how can we change this, where maybe you didn't before?
Yes, I think so. I think I'm starting to realise that it's okay to ask for help, and that it's okay to perhaps say why. It helps me sometimes to see things, you know, if I've got a bit of a, if I can think, hang on, if I do this, I'm super privileged. If I do this, I'm able to set a precedent for people who've got less privilege than me, who are facing much, you know, more significant struggles. If I go along with doing it in this way that's really awful for me, I'm just enabling this culture. And I did quite a lot of that with the one, like, support of my publishers, who've been amazing, resisting quite a lot of the normal ways of doing things around book publicity, not doing things for free, saying when things weren't okay, even if it was to an editor of a newspaper who had agreed to do a thing about the book. And I also, you know, asked for things to be done in a way that works for me. If, say, visually I was sent something to look at and it was just too distracting because there were loads of different colours and boxes and things, like, actually, I can't see that. I can't process that. I need it to be in a different format. So could it be provided in a different format? And I did that for a project I was working on, and it turns out that nobody liked it. Actually, it was really hard for everybody. And but they sort of got used to doing it that way in lockdown. And because I'd said, I think everybody breathed a big sigh of relief, said, actually, this doesn't work at all, and it's costing us loads more money. And that helps me, I think, sometimes advocate for myself a little bit more, to think about it as, I've got to do it, even if I don't feel like I'm able to do it for myself, I feel like I have to do it for other people. And yeah, and it's amazing how actually mostly people aren't awful about it. They're just really accommodating and nice. So.
Well, I think the more this conversation is had, the more people understand that it's a thing that they need to consider. Obviously, with your project in particular, with your book, there's an awareness there, presumably, around it with the people that are working with you to say, this is the situation. I mean, I know, like, working on a podcast with producers and things, everybody seems so aware in a lovely, lovely, lovely kind of supportive, cosseting way. And so, you know, by publishing not one but two books that will continue this conversation in people's homes and in libraries and all sorts of places, hopefully that kind of those barriers will keep being shoved down.
I hope so. I think everybody does a little tiny piece of it, and those who can do more can do more do, and then everything sort of gets there, and you don't feel like you're shouting into a void.
That's true.
Good.
I know we talked about our childhoods last time we spoke. Mm. And I think boom and bust, I mean, I don't even know if that was a thing in the 80s, but definitely it was all boom. It was all boom in the 80s. Yeah. It was fine. But, like, I look back at my childhood and think when I was eight, I started at a very strict, very academic school, you know, where the hours were like 8 till 4:30 and you did Saturday school. And it was a completely different environment of sitting at your desk all day, every day. And that led to you know, a complete, I mean, if you can have a breakdown at eight, I had a breakdown at eight, and then OCD and self-harm and all those things at 8 or 9 years old. And obviously that was massively indicative of anxiety, and it was anxiety, but at the root of it, I can see now, was literally you changed the way that my brain was supposed to work. It didn't work the way that you wanted it to, and I didn't fit into those structures that you wanted me to kind of fit into, and it all just went bust, basically. And I could work really hard. I very quickly rose to sort of the top five of the class and all those things, having had very little kind of academic training in terms of how you learn and all those kind of things. I just did it because I had to do it. And I'd quite often secretly stay up till 2 a.m. revising, you know, my Latin verbs or whatever. The point is that that cycle of boom and bust was set up at eight, and I had absolutely no capacity to deal with it. Whereas I feel like now as an adult, obviously there's a different support network around me and I don't have the same shame that I had at eight, but it's a completely different cycle now. It's still based on that same trauma, like you say, but I can cope with it differently, and I can ask for help, and I can do all the things I need to do. And perhaps also being an adult, I have perspective, so I understand that the ramifications of screwing up aren't what they were. Is boom and bust something that you think that actually looking back has been a constant from childhood?
Yes, I think so. And as you were speaking then, the other difference, you were saying there's sort of a difference between the childhood boom and bust and the adult. That's, to me, it's also power. You know, there is nobody, I mean, being a kid at school is not, it's not in a very powerful position unless the adults around you put you in a position of power. But yeah, as a kid, my parents gave me last year some paperwork that they'd found, old school reports, and there was one that we'd obviously been asked to write our own school report. I was nine. And I thought it was funny the first time I read it, and then I realised it was really, really upsetting. So I was doing really, really well at school. I had some things which I can now see. It took me a really long time to learn to read, and then I did it overnight when I got interested in it. There was absolutely no concerns with any of my schoolwork. I was doing fantastically. And this report, I actually counted the words and counted that it's out of 400 words, 200 and something are about me trying harder or improving, learning how to be better. I used the phrase, I must try harder, I will try harder, I will do better, I won't rush. I use it so many times. And I was nine, I wrote it in beautiful handwriting. And it's actually really, really, really unbearable once you realise that this wasn't a child who needed to try any harder at all. And yet I was in this position where I had already internalised that the couple of times I had rushed, you know, I've never been good at spelling and grammar, I just can't make those things stick. Turns out you're still allowed to be a writer. those things, those little tiny places where I had showed that, as soon as I'd got that feedback, that it was internalized and I was giving it back to myself, it was so punishing. And it was all on me. There was no bit where I said I'd like more help with this, or I wish. It was all I have to try harder. And I look at that now and I think, wow, I was only in year four and I'd already got to that place where that seemed normal, and nobody read that and thought this isn't okay. But I tell you what, I as a parent am on the lookout for that with my children. Possibly too much. They'll never try ever in their whole lives. But the trying hard is the negative bit of boom for me, because I do try hard and I'm very self-motivated. So the extra driver that I must try harder, I must be better, I must improve, that's where it becomes punitive and unhelpful. And that's where the cycle, as an adult, I'm hopefully more able to disentangle myself from that, particularly because there are very few people telling me, because I've got myself out of those situations.
You set your own goals and your own standards, don't you? You don't have someone, you know, you only get a pay rise if XYZ happens, etc.
Exactly. I mean, that has its own sort of downsides, but it's definitely for me, and I, that's why, you know, loads of people with ADHD are entrepreneurial or creative or, you know, freelance. Here is a structure in which they're not going to be put in that position and not going to have to spend as much of their energy on looking at the mirror of the outside world and trying to straighten their hair and tie and things in response to that.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining me. It was an amazing chat, and I feel like we have another 7 hours probably to cover.
Of course. Always.
It's my Always. Only issue with this whole thing is that we want to obviously keep it nice and succinct and brief and all those things, but actually there's so much to go through. This is my therapy.
We now turn to an expert. Today, it's Dr. Mohamed Abdelghany. He is a lead consultant psychiatrist specialising in adult ADHD, both for the NHS and at his private practice, Dyad Medical, in London. When it was first suggested that I might have ADHD, I wanted to find a psychiatrist that had run an NHS service and a private practice, just to make sure that they'd seen the full spectrum of what ADHD can look like in a woman. Dr. Mohamed Abdelghany was one of the first people I spoke to, and his kindness and openness immediately made me think of him for the podcast, because I know that he'll offer so many of you such comfort. And so I'm so thrilled to have him here today to decipher, is it my ADHD when I have an exciting day but feel low and unmotivated when it's over?
Yeah, in one of our previous discussions, Grace, I mentioned this boom and bust, and I actually borrowed this term from the chronic fatigue world. So in chronic fatigue, we speak a lot about the boom and bust. And I see it a lot in the clinic, although I didn't see it, at least personally, documented in any scientific literature. But we see it a lot in patients with ADHD, that they have this boom and bust both physically and emotionally. So people with ADHD, other people might see them as the hyperactive child, but actually people with ADHD, a lot of them can struggle to find the energy to continue the day. They feel more lethargic than other people and they have less energy, a lot of them. So, but the same person might also be hyperactive. So it's as if they use their battery early on in the day and then they run out of battery later on. So you see this a lot physically, that they would be very active and then you ask them to do a simple chore with you and they completely ran out of energy. And emotionally, it's the same, as if they want to get the most out of the moment. So they really emotionally invest themselves in situations. And then during the same day or during the same week, they might not find the emotional energy to engage or to enjoy things as other people would be able to do.
Thank you so much for joining me and this community of amazing people. We'd love it if you could follow Is It My ADHD wherever you get your podcast from. And now I'd love to hear from you. What other perspectives would you like to see explored in future episodes? Find me on Instagram at Is It My ADHD to continue the conversation.